In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about movies. And our guest for the program is Kenneth Turan. He's film critic at the Los Angeles Times and has been there at the paper for more than 10 years. He can also be heard every Friday morning as film critic for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He's also a director of the Los Angeles Times Book Prizes and makes his home in Los Angeles. And it's been good enough to come spend some time with us this morning. He is joining us on the telephone to talk about movies. He has a new book out, by the way, that's a collection of reviews that's titled Never Coming to a Theater Near You, A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Movie. And it's published by Public Affairs Books. We'll talk a little bit about that. And if you have questions about movies, comments about movies, occasionally on the show we do talk about film and give people the opportunity to call in and talk about movies that you have seen. Tell us what you have seen, what you'd like to recommend, what you'd like to tell people to stay away from. And certainly if you have comments on Mr. Turan and some of his reviews, no doubt you've heard him on Morning Edition, well, you can give us a call. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, Kenneth Turan, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. One of the questions, this question actually was prompted by a colleague and who made the observation that we do have major critics at different parts of the country. You're based in Los Angeles. Here in our part of the country, we have one very well-known fellow named Roger Ebert, who lives in Chicago. And then there are critics that I associate with New York, and I guess I'd have to say I don't really know if they live there, but you know, the people who write for, like David Denby, who writes for The New Yorker, or Elvis Mitchell and A.O. Scott and people like that that review for The New York Times. And I guess I wonder, do you think that critics, depending on where they are, East Coast, West Coast, middle of the country, have different ways of reviewing or different ways of looking at movies?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, critics, we have talked among ourselves about this because every once in a while, unfortunately, I can't think of an example, but every once in a while a film will come up that critics who live in New York will view a certain way, and critics who live in Los Angeles, even if they write for East Coast publications, there's a lot of critics who write for East Coast publications who live out here, they will see it a different way. And I'm not talking about films that are about New York or LA where you'd think there'd be this difference. But it does happen, I think, in some indefinable way where you live affects you. You know, I mean, I'm always saying reviewing is personal. Everything that makes up your life goes into what you think about a given film. And so I think it's natural that even if it's in undefinable ways, where you live has an impact on you.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you make, and it's something that I'm not sure people really do understand to the extent of which reviewing is personal, and that what you're getting is indeed one individual's opinion, and it may be an informed opinion because it's the opinion of someone who has seen a lot of movies, but it is, after all, their opinion, and that doesn't, you know, because they like a movie, that doesn't necessarily mean that you will like it, or if they dislike it, you know, it's sort of a matter of, well, it is partly a matter of personal taste.
Yeah, I think very much so, and I think critics, because we tend to, for professional reasons, have to sound so sure when we write or when we talk, I think critics shy away from really emphasizing this, but, you know, one of the things I've often said is that God doesn't speak to me. God doesn't tell me, this is a good movie. It's a question of what I feel, what I believe. As you say, it's an informed opinion. But I think, you know, what people really need to do with critics is find one whose sensibility they connect with and who they can mostly trust. You're never going to find anyone who you agree with 100%. Mm-hmm. But you want someone who you know you connect with, where if they say they like a film, you say, you know, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to like it too.
Well, we have somebody here who would like to join the conversation, and I won't make them wait any longer. Someone here in Urbana, where we are, on our line one. Hello.
Hi, maybe you can help me with the title of the movie that my husband and I can't come up with. It was last few years, and it was about a woman who goes around a country that's very arid, and she's wearing flowing robes, and she's helping with the voting process. Does that strike a chord with you?
It does strike a chord, but not enough of a chord. I believe it's an Iranian film.
I tried looking on the Internet Movie Database. I tried Iran. I tried voting.
You know what I would try? There is, and I think it comes from Chicago, there's a wonderful company called Facets Video, which F-A-C-E-T-S, which rents and sells an enormous range of videos. And I would give them a try and see if they have someone there who knows that. That would be my best guess as to how to help you.
Okay, thank you.
Right, thanks. And maybe there's somebody else who is listening, because I think that you're right. I think it is an Iranian movie, and it is a movie that has been released within the last year or two.
Yeah. It's just, you know, there's so many. Sometimes they just don't, you can't call them, you know, they're like spirits. You can call them forward, but they don't always come.
Well, I'm sure that I saw it at our local New Art Theater. And maybe I should also call them. Thanks for the idea.
All right, thank you. And again, other calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that's another thing that people I think don't always understand about critics, particularly because people like you see so many movies. They don't understand. You know, if I saw a movie a couple of weeks ago and I thought it was very good and very memorable, it may have been a film that you saw, but you may have seen 20 movies since then, and people don't get, well, why don't you remember this movie? You mean you don't know what movie I'm talking about?
Well, you know, and people do. I mean, you know, one of the impetuses for me writing this book is that people do forget the films they wanted to see, the films they wanted to see. You know, they didn't get a chance to see it when it played at the theater, or it didn't come to their area, and they said, boy, when that comes out on video, that's the one I want to see. They go to the video store, and for the life of them, they can't remember what film it was. They're surrounded by all these videos. So one reason I wrote Never Coming to a Theater Near You, or I should say one reason I made this collection, was to help people remember the smaller films that I think are really memorable, that really made my life as a critic worth doing, made it worth sitting through the hours and hours of nonsense I have to sit through. These are the films that were worth it.
I should mention that that's what this book is about. It's a collection of short reviews, 155, I think,
right,
grouped according to films in English language, in foreign languages, documentaries, classics, retrospectives. So again, that's it. Unfortunately, it's not a book that you can put in your pocket. You'll have to sit and look at it at home before you go down to wherever you rent your you want to look at movies. But it is an opportunity to go through and be reminded of some movie that you thought at one time, I would like to see that, and then you didn't get round to it, and it's not. And I must confess that, probably like a lot of people, when I go down to the place to rent movies, the first thing I do is I go to the shelves where they have the new releases.
Right.
And I sort of wander around and see if there's something I can find there. And I know this has happened to me many times. There have been some film that I've thought, well, at some point I'd like to see that. And then it comes off the new release shelf, or maybe it was never on that shelf, and it's somewhere there in the store. But it's not high up on my list of things that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, it's difficult to remember. I mean, and also there are also films that, you know, one of the advantages of being a critic is that you hear about almost everything. You're forced to see almost everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, sometimes you see really terrible things, but sometimes you see films that people have never even heard of. You know, and I've put films in here that some of them most people, you know, likely would. There's one that's especially a favorite of mine that I want to mention if I could.
Sure.
Because it's such an unusual film, and I just fell so in love with it. It's called East Side Story. East Side Story is a documentary about a genre of filmmaking that I only vaguely knew existed, and I had no idea how extensive it was. This is the genre of musicals made behind the Iron Curtain. Musicals made in Russia and East Germany that kind of celebrate the socialist ideal, that have people singing and dancing around tractors at harvest time. It's stuff that you just would not believe. And it's told very tongue-in-cheek, but very realistically. This is actual, really happened with serious filmmaking when it was done. And it's just a wonderful film. I mean, if you're a movie lover, to discover this whole kind of movie that you only vaguely knew existed, if you knew at all, is just such a treat.
I would have had no inkling that there was such a thing.
Oh, it's, I mean, there's one film that Stalin loved. He watched it hundreds of times. Apparently, he sent a copy to Franklin D. Roosevelt because he liked it so much. You know, I mean, there are these films and these stories about these films that were really just, it's so cheerful, it's so energetic, it's so much fun to watch this film. And there's also, at the very end of it, there's a line in the credits that say, you know, the last thing you see on the screen is that this film is dedicated to Karl Marx, without whom none of these musicals would have been necessary.
Very nice. We have some other callers here. We have someone on our line number one that I'm told is actually calling from our pledge center. This must be our friend Dave Teal, who is also the program director of our public TV station here, WILL-TV.
That's correct, yes. I had a question this morning. Some friends of mine and I were discussing a movie that came out this weekend, Team America World Police. And, reading some of the reviews out there, it seemed like a lot of people missed the point of the film, or at least what I perceived to be the point of it, and seemed to be, you know, kind of taking it to task for maybe actually kind of promoting a view that, you know, is in favor of the war on terror and kind of, you know, the very jingoistic point of view. And I thought it seemed to be very obviously an ironic take on things. And a lot of people seem to be missing the irony. And I wondered what your take on it was, you know, being out in L.A., you know, kind of your reaction to the way it treats, if nothing else, the activist celebrities that are portrayed in the film.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. I think, you know, I liked the daring of it. I liked the marionettes. I liked, you know, the fact that it was different and kind of off the wall. I felt, you know, the way it seemed to me, it felt kind of, you know, I think what they're trying to do is have a plague on both your houses approach, you know. They're kind of fed up with a lot of things that are almost mutually exclusive. I think the first part of the film is kind of, you know, this kind of, as you say, ironic kind of look at, our invasion techniques, where we're kind of going in and thinking we're helping people, and in fact we're blowing everything up. You know, we consider a mission in Paris a success, even though the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower have been destroyed. But then the second half, it shifts completely, and you really get this kind of very personal attack on these activist celebrities, which, you know, this whole film feels very personal to me. It feels like the two filmmakers really are kind of fed up with the war and fed up with the activist celebrities, and they're kind of humorously poking fun at both sides of the spectrum. But so, you know, I think it kind of, by means of their own personal feelings, they want to have it both ways. I was frankly, and, you know, you feel kind of old when you say this, I didn't laugh as much at the profanity as I wanted to, as I thought the film wanted me to. It almost starts to feel like these guys have taken being outrageous as kind of a job that they have to do, and it's just not fun anymore. It's not funny anymore, but, you know, they have to do it. So I was just kind of let down. I didn't laugh as much as I wanted to, especially in the second half.
The one thing that I had thought, at least, you know, just as a viewer of the film, I took it to be not just a spoof of the kind of the Jerry Bruckheimer really over-the-top jingoistic film, but just in general kind of a wish fulfillment fantasy where, you know, you get Michael Moore blown up and, well, and all sorts of celebrities getting mown down. And I saw some reviewers seem to be taking that as very, you know, anti those people, but it just seemed to me that it was more just kind of a wish fulfillment thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, but I mean, I guess maybe one of the things that, you know, it felt to me almost too personal, especially the second half. I mean, it almost felt like they took the attitude, which a lot of people have, well, these people are celebrities, they're rich, they're famous, we can do anything we want to them, you know, and we can make any kind of fun of them, we can make any kind of personal remarks about them, and you can, you know, and they did, and sometimes they're funny, and sometimes they just don't feel funny, and when remarks like that don't feel funny, they kind of lose all reason for existence.
Sure. Well, thanks very much. I'm going to go back to counting pledges.
All right. We'll talk to you in a little while.
All right.
We have some other folks here also who want to talk with us, and we will go next to a caller in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello. Yes.
I'm hoping you can give me a real broad brushstrokes on this question. I've been seeing personally films since about 1942. And I have a rather large collection, and the other day I was going through it, and though I knew this was the truth, I was just sort of amazed that practically everything I have is pre-1955, which would mean it's at the period where the studio situation was changing drastically. And I don't have that many Technicolor films, and I find that when I see contemporary films or films, you know, the 70s and 80s, they somehow just don't spark with me, and I'm beginning to think, well, I'm just an old fogey, that there's something about growing up in a period of time where, whenever you are, is that those are the films and those are the music you remember. But unfortunately, with the music, it's that situation is not at all conventional. I was into jazz when other people were doing rock and roll, And, you know, the Beatles to me is just another group that sang. I don't go crazy about them. But certainly with the films, to my sensibility, there's something distinct, but I sure in hell can't find the name for it. And I just wondered if in the circles you work with or in the academic world and film studies, whether there is sort of a broad stroke, you know, in there somewhere other than that, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that sort of thing, whether it's some sort of genre thing that's going on, you know, like the auteur view and the things like that. I just wonder if there's any broad strokes in there that just doesn't make any difference. I'm still going to collect films from the 30s and 40s, but I just wondered, you know, where the hell do I fit in all this? Because usually when people like you come on, they're talking about films I have no interest in seeing whatsoever unless a number of people say something that particular catches my, otherwise, you know, I'm not helping the film industry too much by at least attending the actual showing. So that's my question.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, I think you've hit on something that's very interesting. And, you know, one of the things that's happened is that the film business has changed radically in our lifetime. During the era you're talking about, during the era when the films were made that you really connect to, Hollywood saw itself and, in fact, had a broad national audience. They made films really for everyone. And, you know, they didn't have the competition of TV. They didn't have the competition of video. Everyone went to the movies, and the studios felt a kind of need and obligation and kind of fiscal imperative to make movies for everyone. And really now everyone is not going to the movies. The greater part of the movie audience is quite young, especially for Hollywood movies. And Hollywood more and more and more is making movies for a very young dynamic, a very young demographic, I mean. And they're saying they're movies for everyone, but in fact they're not movies for everyone. The last time Hollywood really did make movies for everyone, and everyone went, was in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So there really has been a change in the kind of film that's been made, and I think that's one of the things you're picking up on. And again, as I'm sure you know, you're not alone. There's a lot of people who look back on those times as the golden age of American movie making.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go on to talk with somebody else. Charleston, this is line number two. Hello.
Yes. I have a question regarding, I don't know where or who made the movie, but I saw it in Champaign at the Art Theater, The Rabbit Proof Fence.
Yes. This one I know.
You do.
Wonderful. What can I tell you? What do you want to know about it?
Well, the thing that I got out of it was the tenacity of those children, the oppression of the British or the Aussies by then, you know, which perhaps you can tell me if Australia was a prison camp, just like the U.S. was early on, and how and what they did to the indigenous peoples. And it was very riveting for me because I could understand the political and economic portent of the film. And maybe you can confirm those things, but it spoke to me grandly because of those children and their ability to survive under those horrendous conditions.
Yeah, now, Rabbit Proof Fence is based on a true story. It's an Australian film. It's directed by an Australian director named Philip Noyce. And it's, you know, at the time, I think the film is set, if I remember, in the 50s, and Australia had very kind of racist policies towards its native peoples, and they had put this enormous fence around. I mean, it wasn't like it was a prison camp, but they had put a huge fence across part of the country to make it difficult for people to get out. I guess it's, you know, but I mean, it covered a huge area, so it doesn't have the kind of prison camp feeling that those words, you know, kind of signify. But it's really, as you say, the two parts of the film are the kind of the horror at the way the Australians treated the Aboriginal people, and the kind of incredible tenacity of these two girls who just didn't want to have their lives ruled in a way that they found unacceptable. And your really heart goes out to them as you see them kind of battling, to, you know, really for freedom.
Yes, and she made that trip, I think the movie said, twice or three times.
Yeah, they kept catching her and bringing her back into this area, and she kept trying to leave again.
Yes, and then the whole thing was fraught with racism, as I recall, too. You know, some of the written matter on the screen and the blending of white and indigenous people, and somehow they would the intermarriage would be finally done in by making them white again.
I mean, you see a film like this and you see what people believed in all sincerity at that period of time, you really have to wonder, what are we believing in all sincerity now?
Yes.
That in 50 years people are going to say, how could they believe that?
Yes, and it applies, too, to American racism and Native Americans here and poor bleeding Africa this very day and all the things that the English and others accomplished in that horrendous place, you know, to the southern part of Africa, you know, the northern Arabic domination, you know, was what it was. But in southern Africa, where, you know, they still lived a subsistence life, and then the Brits and others went down, and the whole history is just one of... But that film pointed up for me what the history of the colonialist ideas and those things that, you know, we don't seek land anymore. It's now markets. And then the film industry, American film industry, I think plays into a lot of that. You know, I'm not a big on movies anymore, but I, as a young person, a kid, you know, I was a John Wayne fan, believe it or not. It was just, this fellow was the worst of the worst, and yet his movies portrayed him as in heroics. And the activities of what they did in Texas and some of the other, you know, those anti-Native American films and all. But nevertheless, I mean, that there's a lot of outside knowledge has to go with going to the movies. Children, you know, that view movies as children, and adults, you know, like you're the previous caller about this puppet movie. You know, how do we internalize all that and somehow try to get at some truth, you know, and it becomes very hard to do. But I guess that's why I like The Rabbit Proof Fence, because it was kind of straightforward. And, well, thanks for your time, sir, and I appreciate the program, David.
All right, well, thank you very much. We're about at a midpoint here. One thing that we would like to do is to take a couple of minutes again here to remind folks just how important the support is, their financial support is for the station. And, Mr. Tran, if you won't mind just holding on there for a moment.
Oh, not at all.
And listen to us carry on here where we ask people for their support. People who listen to public radio are kind of used to this. It comes with the territory. It is, however, one of the times that we have the opportunity to actually sit down in front of the microphone and to, in a personal sort of way, say, look, that people like us who work in public broadcasting, it means a lot to us. We really have a lot invested in the kind of thing that we do and the approach that we take. And when we talk to listeners from time to time, you know, they really say the same thing. I know that there are a lot of people who listen to the station and these programs regularly who also feel invested in it. Some of them even are willing to support it with their own money to sit down at periodically and write a check because they know we got to pay the bills. And now an awful lot of the money that it takes to run the station actually comes from people who listen. This is one of those times we say, okay, folks, now is the time. If you're already a supporter of the station, great. If you're not, though, this will be an opportunity for you to sign on, maybe just at the basic level, just at the $40 level. The more, if you could, would be great, but just a basic contribution would also be great. And if we could get everybody who listens to do that, we wouldn't have any budget problems. So give us a call, 244-9455. That's what we're asking for this morning. Jack Brighton is here, our web guy, producer emeritus, Focus 580, sometimes
right.
Substitute host, who still retains a... some interest in what it is we do here on Focus 5.
Oh, indeed. I listen to the show all the time. I'm a big fan. And I actually pledge to the station. So not only am I a member of the Hair Club for... No, I mean the Friends of WILL. But also joining us, David Teal is our TV program director, and he's volunteered to talk in the Pledge Center about what's going on out there. And I know one thing that we talked about during this hour was making sure to hit up the people who have never contributed to WILL, the new Friends of WILL. The station depends on a growing cast of characters out there supporting it. And so if you have just discovered WILL, just moved to the area, et cetera, then please consider joining us. This is your NPR station, so we'd like to make it official by having you join us in the Friends of WILL, 217-244-9455 to make that pledge call. And David Teal, I think I recognized a familiar voice on the show just a few minutes ago. Did you indeed call in a question on the air?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, because honestly, I can't I couldn't resist the opportunity. I mean, it's an opportunity for me, at least, to speak with Kenneth Turan for a moment. And as I said, you know, this was something that I'd been thinking about this weekend and reading some of the reviews. And so it was, you know, it's nice to have that chance. And you may occasionally hear me call in to Focus or Afternoon Magazine if I'm out in the car and, you know, driving around at some point and I hear, you know, if we're on a topic that's of interest. I mean, I do call in because I think it's a great opportunity to really to, you know, talk to some interesting people and you know, and in a way that it is not it's not, you know, too partisan, not too, you know, argumentative like
sure.
you might find in some other talk radio. So, yeah, I couldn't resist, but and I really appreciate the opportunity. And I think, you know, I do value these programs personally.
Okay. Now, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a member of the Friends of WILO?
Oh, absolutely. Now, you know, obviously, I do work here, so, you know, there is that. But I also... But yeah, I do think that the programs that happen not just on television, which I work for,
well, you know,
but on radio.
I was just gonna say, I bet most of the people who work here at WILL also contribute to the station, and I don't want to hold us up as any kind of shining example, but we also know that only 1 out of 10 listeners out there support the station. So I think the proportion certainly among the staff here is higher than that. So I don't want to get into any kind of competitive sort of you know comparison here, but I do want to say that for those of you who have never contributed, and I know there's a lot of you out there, and we don't want to make you feel guilty necessarily, but we do want to make you pick up the telephone and make a call to the pledge line, 217-244-9455. If we could just bump it up to 2 out of 10 listeners who contribute to the station, it would, like David said, it would solve the budget problem once and for all. So please consider it and actually do it.
All right. Well, thank you both very much. We want to continue our conversation with Kenneth Turan. He has been film critic at the Los Angeles Times for more than 10 years. He also can be heard Friday mornings as film critic for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He has a new book out that is a collection of short reviews. The title of the book is Never Coming to a Theater Near You, a celebration of a certain kind of movie, and it's published by Public Affairs Books. And I think his idea, as he explained a little earlier in the program, was to remind people of some of the titles of good movies, things that they might have heard about, things they might at one time have thought about seeing but have forgotten. Maybe they forgot the title, forgot who was in it, forgot what it was all about. But they're looking for suggestions, so when they go down to wherever it is they rent their DVDs or their videotapes, they might consider some of those movies. And they're organized in different categories. They're English language films, foreign language films, documentaries, classics, and a section of retrospectives where he looks at sort of categories of films and talks about different titles. And that indeed was the – I think that was the – The one, no, I guess it was in the documentaries that you had the one that was about the musical. It was a documentary about the socialist
East Side Story.
Musical East Side Story. Right. and questions are certainly welcome if folks would like to call in and talk with our guest about movies. You can do that. 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So all you have to do is just pick up the phone and do that. You talked, in response to an earlier caller, you talked about one of the big changes in the movie business having been that at one time, Hollywood studios thought they were making movies for everyone, and now they know perfectly well that they're not. There's much more targeting of audiences, particularly of younger audiences. So that's one way that things have changed. When I was a kid, if you were going to watch a movie at home, there was only one alternative, and that is whatever came out of the television set and whatever happened to be, if you were just lucky enough to stumble on something. And, of course, now people have cable, have satellite, have tape, have DVDs, have all sorts of possibilities for watching movies at home. Now, people still are going out to the movies, but I guess I wonder how you think that the possibility of expanded home viewing, what does that mean for the business of movies?
Well, I mean, I think the possibilities are already here. You know, what it means is that a lot of people, again, let me start from the other end of the spectrum. Teenagers, people in their 20s, there's almost a built-in need to go out, see your friends, have the theatrical experience. there are social reasons to go to the movies when you're that age. And I think people are always going to go when they're that age. And people still like the communal experience when they get older, but the hassle factor gets greater. And people have other things to do, and it's simpler to see things at home. And I think we're seeing that now with home theaters, with all these methods of seeing films at home, that the older audience is staying home and watching films at home. That's just what they're doing. And they just, it's too much trouble for an uncertain return to go out to the theaters. And I think, you know, that's going to increase, but I think it's pretty much of a reality right now. And, you know, people just, as screens get bigger and as it gets easier to, you know, there's talk of having new movies on demand, you know, through various transmission systems, digital transmission systems at home. And if that happens, it will further cut down the theatrical attendance. But I think the theater will never go away, because even for me and even for people who see a lot of films and see a lot of films at home, there's something about being in an enormous room, a dark room with a lot of like-minded people, with a big screen up there, with the film unfolding. It's a wonderful feeling. It's, people have described it as kind of an around-the-campfire feeling. Yeah. And I think people, no matter what you can get at home, that's an experience you can't get. And I think people are always going to want that.
Well, let's talk with someone else who was listening here, someone in Urbana, and it's line number one.
Yes, I'm concerned about how to develop critical thinking skills when people see documentaries that are very definitely slanted in particular directions. And, of course, I'm thinking about Michael Moore's Fahrenheit film.
I could have guessed.
I have friends who've told me facts from this and say, well, you know, that was in the film. I mean, did you know this? And it seems to me that I won't say proselytizing, but a slightly jaded documentary has to be looked at in a different way from a documentary that is just simply presenting how something went and doesn't have a particular slant to give. And I just wonder what comments you have to make about that, and if you also had that experience of people whom you know who thought that everything that was said was the gospel truth.
No, I mean, most people, I think, are very, you know, we live in an age of enormous cynicism, and most people I know are cynical about everything that they see.
I see.
I think the Michael Moore film is, it doesn't pretend to be anything. I mean, I think the word you used is an apt word. It's a proselytizing film.
Yes.
I think he makes no bones about that.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's trying, he has a point of view he's trying to get across, and, it either works for people or it doesn't. I think I have never seen a film least likely to change minds than Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yes, yes.
I think people who agree with it, and people who went in not agreeing with it, they go out not
Absolutely.
Agreeing with it.
I think he did a good job of what he was trying to do, but I just don't know how people can be helped to go in with alert minds and say, oh, well, you know, maybe I need to check this out, or, oh, that isn't what I understood.
Well, you know, I think across society as a whole, if people read newspapers more, listen to National Public Radio
uh-huh.
more, inform themselves more, that's the best thing you can
sure.
do for, you know, not only for going into movies, but for, you know, voting intelligently. I mean, really, I think we live in a soundbite world, and people don't want to take the time and energy to actually read about things and look into things and gather information.
So we need to read and think and talk before we see a documentary of this sort, and then as a follow-up, do those same things again.
I think absolutely. I mean, I hope that's not a controversial position.
No, but I'm afraid it's not common. Sometimes.
No, it's. I agree with you. It is not common. I wish it was more common, but, I mean, that's what I want to push people to do is,
yes.
you know, inform themselves.
Well, more power to you, and thank you for taking my call.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Fahrenheit 9/11, this movie that we've talked about and has caused so much debate and conversation, has the distinction of being the highest-grossing feature-length documentary ever. And recently, there have been several documentaries, among them Super Size Me, about the man who spent a month eating every meal at McDonald's. And there was one that was about the National Spelling Bee.
Spellbound.
Spellbound. There have been several of these movies that have done very, very well financially. And some people have said, well, maybe we're seeing here something new, something akin to the breakthrough of independent films that started with Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And some people have said, you know, are we embarked on a new, perhaps golden age for feature-length documentary movies?
Well, you took the words out of my mouth, the words that I have written several times. We are living in a golden age of feature-length documentaries. There's no doubt about it. This is the best time for feature-length documentaries I think there's ever been. And I think there's a variety of reasons for it. I mean, number one, this is one place where digital cameras and the ease of shooting something and the inexpensiveness of shooting something digitally has really helped. If you have a good idea for a documentary, you can get one of these little cameras, you can shoot it, and if it's interesting and well done, it can end up in theaters. You don't need the enormous apparatus of cameras and camera crews that you used to have. So it has liberated people to take on interesting subjects that previously they knew were interesting but could never raise the money for. It's very inexpensive to do this.
And you think that more theater chains or theater owners are willing to put a documentary in their theaters?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, even before, I mean, Fahrenheit 9/11 blew the roof off of this thing because, I mean, if we would have been talking a year ago and I would have said to you, you know, there's a documentary that's going to come out, it's going to earn over $100 million in American box office, they would have come in with a straitjacket and taken me away. This is unprecedented. But even before Fahrenheit 9/11, there was, as you mentioned, Spellbound. Spellbound came out of nowhere, had no political context, had no built-in audience. It was a real word-of-mouth hit. People saw it. They liked it. They told their friends told more friends. It became a very substantial financial hit. When these films start to make money, everyone notices. It's just, as you say, with the independent movement. Everyone says, oh, wait a minute, people are seeing these. Maybe it's not so risky for us to distribute one. Maybe as a theater owner, it's not so risky for me to put it on my screen. People are coming and paying money. You know, the power in the movie industry is to the people who pay the money. That's why the teenagers have the power, because they pay the money week after week. And people who like documentaries are starting to pay money, and we're going to see more of them.
Well, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi, great conversation. I'm a long-time listener, long-time contributor to WILL.
Glad to hear it.
So your job as a critic, as a movie critic, is to kind of look at movies for more than their face value, try to understand the meaning, derive the impact that this movie might have for people, try to help people decode the meaning. The previous caller had mentioned Michael Moore's movie as being just strictly a biased piece. Well, maybe we can expand that discussion. Anybody who watches Fox News or the Sinclair News Group, anybody who watches a pharmaceutical commercial or a credit card company commercial or a personal injury lawyer commercial, I think those are also areas that we need to be critical in that same kind of way. So I was wondering if you could maybe offer some specific ideas for the general public on how do you look at all media with a critical eye? Critical not being this is bad, this is good, but critical meaning, what's the real meaning? What's the real message? How can we really understand the true intent or the true meaning of what they're saying? That kind of critical. So I'm not going to listen offline, but I just wanted to kind of hear your perspective on that. There is definitely a lack of teaching in the schools about how to listen to the media critically, and maybe we can go ahead and come up with a couple of ideas that will help listeners to do that. And I'll listen.
Right.
Thanks.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, the first step is exactly what you're saying, and I think the first step is the understanding and kind of the internalizing of the notion that, and unfortunately it is, you know, it's a sign of our times, most of the things we see and hear is made with an eye towards influencing us. We have to understand going in that much of what we see is really wants to get a certain action out of us, wants to get a certain opinion out of us, wants to do something to us, and we have to kind of bring that attitude to more things than we do. We have to, you know, understand that we live in a world of manipulation, especially imagery manipulation, and everyone is trying to use us, you know, and to sell us things and to sell us points of view. And I think just that realization, that understanding, is really the key first step in dealing with all the stuff we're flooded with. It doesn't mean that you necessarily disagree with it, but you have to, view everything with a grain of salt. You have to say, what is this trying to do to me? Where is this coming from? What are they trying to say to me? What are they trying to sell me? Well, how are they trying to influence me? And I think most people don't want to look at things that way. And I think you have to more and more look that way, or else you will be taken advantage of.
All right, let's talk with someone in Chicago. Line number four. Hello.
Hi, you said it's the golden age of documentaries. I think it might be because it's the rough age of screenplays. I have more or less stopped going to see movies mainly, and usually I wait until something's highly recommended. And I'm going to give you an example because this has driven me crazy, and I'd like another view on it. When I went to see The Contenders, I left totally puzzled. Now, in The Contenders, supposedly the senator was from the Stone Age, and he was against this poor woman being appointed because she was a female. Yet, my understanding from the play was that he was against her because she was disloyal. And in the hearings, it turns out that she had cheated on her best friend and stolen her husband from her, which I think is a pretty good example of being disloyal. And I left there totally confused because I thought he had a good point. So that's what I mean. Did I miss something? Was there something else going on that she truly was loyal? I don't know, but it's movies like that that make me say, I'm not going to go see another movie.
Well, it's movies like that that made me put this book together, because hopefully the films that I recommend in this book, and my book and Never Coming to a Theater Near You, are films that you can trust, films that are, you know, I feel I'm willing to stand behind. You can come call me up and yell at me if you don't like them. There's not a lot of good films out there. I mean, I think I estimated when I came to figure it out that the films that are in this book, they're like 5% of the movies I've seen over a 10-12 year period. 5%. A lot of the movies are just not worth it. It's just unfortunate, and it's difficult for people to know what films are worth it. And these are the ones that I would see again in a minute. These are the films that I'm happiest about, the ones that I think, you know, I would recommend everyone seeing, and I think almost no one's going to like all of them, but I think most people will like most of them.
I will get your book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. We'll try to get at least one more in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
While you're talking about documentaries, and I don't know if this is included in your book or not, but my husband and I saw a film that we left saying every American should be forced to go see this film. Saw it here at the New Art Theater. It was Robert McNamara's film. I think it's called On the Fogs of War.
The Fog of War.
The Fog of War. I found it, its truth, its message, his more almost what was on his face than what he was saying. It was a fantastic film, and hardly anybody saw it.
Yeah, it's not in my book. I almost put it in. It's good enough to be in there. Just, you know, at the last minute, you can't have an endless book. But I think it's a terrific documentary, partly because of, you know, again, you have Robert McNamara. You see his mindset. You see the changes that went through his thinking over the years. It's just so revealing, and it's so beautifully made. I really agree. I think this is a film that everyone would really love to see.
Well, I don't know if they'd love it, but I think everybody should understand what happened then, and failure to understand that means we're going to repeat it, and that's what we're doing. So,
absolutely.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, and we'll go again. Line number two in Champaign also. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make some comments about the Rabbit Proof Fence.
Sure.
There is a book that the daughter of the leader of those three girls, the oldest, has written. She wrote the story. It's called Rabbit Proof Fence, and it's Merrimack's books, Hyperion. And actually, it took place not in the 50s. It took place in 1931. And then the two of them got back. The third one never got back, the one in the middle. But they went and hid out in the desert, but then she later married, and I think her children were born about 36 and 40, maybe, or 35 and 39. And in January of 1941, she ran away again because she had been taken with the two children back to the home. And she got all the way back, but she had to leave the four-year-old there. She took the 18-month-old, and it's the four-year-old that wrote the book. And when she was three, the younger one was taken away, and they've never seen her again. She's she has refused overtures by the family. But the one who was four when the mother escaped again and had to leave her there, Hitt is the one that wrote the book. And it's my understanding, I can't find the exact date, but I think he said in the movie that this policy endured until 1971, or the 70s. And it was a policy not for full-blood Aborigines, but for mixed Aborigines. And as the caller earlier said, to try to breed half-breeds with half-breeds. I know that's a terrible word, but that's how they referred to it, so that they would eventually breed out the black. So it's pretty frightening, but it's not that much different from the policies here in the United States with our Aboriginal people.
Right. And it is, you know, the book obviously came first. The book is, you know, the basis of the film. And, you know, the reason it's published by Miramax is that Miramax distributed the film.
Right. I think it had another, I don't know, might have had another name before. But the rabbit-proof fence was not to keep people in or out. It was the mistaken belief that the rabbits that the whites brought from Europe and who bred out of hand because there were no natural enemies, they wanted to keep them out of the fields. But if the fence was anything like the one pictured in the movie, it sure wouldn't have done the job, and it didn't. But it was what the girls followed to get home, because once they ran into the fence, they knew they could find their way home.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Another recommendation for both book and movie. We're at the point, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to wrap up. I know we could keep going for a long time, but we're going to have to finish. We want to, again, recommend, if you're interested in some recommendations for good films, you can take the word of our guest, Kenneth Turan. He is a film critic for the LA Times and NPR's Morning Edition. He's put together a collection of short reviews. Were these reviews that you did for NPR, or were these also some of them done for the paper?
These were ones done for the paper.
Okay.
These were ones done for the paper. And, you know, some of the same films I did for NPR, I wrote, you know, other versions of the reviews for NPR.
Right. All right. It's a collection of reviews. The title of the book is Never Coming to a Theater Near You, A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Movie. If you'd like to rent for home viewing something that's really good, you can take a look at this book and get some suggestions. And you might learn about something that you had never heard of, or it might remind you that there was some movie that you were wanting to see that you hadn't done. The book's published by Public Affairs. And, of course, you can look for our guest, Kenneth Turan, on NPR's Morning Edition every Friday morning on Morning Edition. He does reviews. Well, Mr. Turan, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
We appreciate it.